He attended Harvard, NYU Medical, and Johns Hopkins. He is today faculty at Georgetown Medical, Johns Hopkins, and the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences. And he is a sharp critic of U.S. News Medical School rankings. Let's hear his story and critique. Welcome to the 321st episode of Mission Straight Talk, Accepted's podcast dedicated to graduate missions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you show that you both fit in at your target schools and are a standout in the applicant pool. The result, you get a message one day that causes you to jump up and down shouting, "Yes, I'm in," and not only in, but in at the best program for you. Before I introduce our guest, I'd like to invite you to download Accepted's free guide, The Ultimate Guide to Medical School Interview Success. Learn how to prepare for your interview, respond to difficult questions, make sure your body language conveys the right message, and follow up after an interview. Again, grab your copy at accepted.com/321download. Now, I'm thrilled to introduce our guest, Dr. Kenny Lin. Dr. Lin earned his bachelor's in history and science from Harvard and then went on to NYU to earn his MD and to Johns Hopkins a little later for an MPH. Today, he is a family practitioner, professor at Georgetown University School of Medicine, the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences, and Johns Hopkins. He also has a blog where he writes about health and medicine and in one post, med school rankings. We'll be talking about that a little later. Dr. Lin, welcome to Admissions Straight Talk.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. Now, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, where you grew up, that kind of thing?
Sure. So I grew up in suburban Maryland. Both my parents are immigrants from Taiwan, although my mom came when she was just a toddler, and my dad didn't come over until graduate school. I don't live far from where I grew up, only about 45 minutes away in D.C., although I, you know, as you mentioned, went to school in a bunch of places up the East Coast. What else about my background is interesting? I don't know. I come from a family where on my mother's side, there were already a few doctors. I think that's part of why what got me interested in medicine. My mom is a pharmacist, but her oldest brother was a doctor for the Air Force, preventive medicine physician, and also her younger sister was a general internist. My grandfather actually was a fairly prestigious doctor in Taiwan. He was a neurologist, and according to the family, I can't verify this, but he apparently consulted for Chiang Kai-shek back before the revolution in China.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. My daughter-in-law comes from a medical family where I think one of her grandfathers was a doctor. Her father's a dentist. Two uncles are doctors. And I think the fourth brother is also something medical technologist, something like that. Now, you mentioned that you're the influence of your mother, but how did you, let's say, explore your interest in medicine personally before you went to medical school?
Well, when I was in high school, I did some volunteering at our, you know, local hospital where my mom worked. I volunteered in like the post-op like recovery room, and, you know, got patients comfortable, brought them drinks and, you know, blankets and things like that. But actually and I think this kind of foreshadowed my sort of dual career in writing and medicine. The other volunteer experience I had at the hospital was I worked with the public relations department, and I got to, you know, design advertisements, like promote the hospital, write little, you know, kind of news blurbs about things that were going on, which I found really enjoyable. And sort of thinking back, that maybe kicked off my kind of writing, editing side of my career too.
Right. And it probably did. And it's interesting that you you didn't pursue the traditional, you know, bio major. You were a history major. Am I correct?
That's right. There was a major at Harvard called History and Science, which was kind of, for me, it was sort of a combination of the pre-medical requirements, but I also took classes in Russian history and also in history of technology, which were two interests of mine. I've always been fascinated by space flight. I really wanted to stay away from kind of the traditional pre-med. You know, I didn't want to be a biology major. I mean, I liked biology, but I felt like everybody who did biology in college wanted to be a doctor, and I wanted to get more kind of a more varied experience, and kind of, you know, sort of, in some ways I was sort of a closet pre-med, I think. Although there wasn't, you know, it's not that I was hiding that I was pre-med, but I think I gravitated toward things that didn't necessarily have anything to do with medicine.
Do you think that the non-traditional or pseudo non-traditional path that you took helped you in both in your medical education and in your practice today, or was it irrelevant and just a matter of personal satisfaction?
I think long term it helped me. In the short term, I remember, the first year of med school, and I was there, and this is when it was much more common to be like a biochemistry major or something, and feeling kind of out of my league, starting first year med school and taking my first biochemistry class ever, because I just taken the minimum requirements, and kind of struggling to kind of find my footing there. But I think long term it really did help, because I feel like I can relate to my patients better. I can I can chat up like a my patients about politics or history or the reading, certain books that I've read or something. It's made me less of, if I had gone through and just solely focused on science or solely focused on medical science in particular, I think it would have made it more challenging to be a family physician.
Why did you add a MPH to your MD?
Well, so that came later on. So I actually finished that, I think like 9 years after I finished my residency is when I finished my PH. Part of it was that I had a period of my career where I worked for the federal government and at the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, where there are a lot of like people who are interested in public health, both physicians and non-physicians. So I got interested in there, but also in my practice, I realized that there are a lot of things that it's less efficient to kind of change one-on-one than it is to kind of change overall. And that, an example is like, you can sort of counsel people one-on-one about losing weight and getting more exercise and eating right. But like, within, if the environment they're living in is that the less nutritious foods are cheaper and more accessible, and there's no place that you can go out and exercise safely, really, like, then it's not efficient, and it's also not practical for most people. And I started to think about, well, are there things that you can do health policy wise? And that's kind of what got me interested in the MPH was health policy. And I was, and this was also around the time that the Affordable Care Act was being debated. It was 2009, 2010 when I started the program. And there was a lot of excitement about that. And there were some components which are actually less known, but the calorie labeling, rule that came out of the Affordable Care Act, everybody focuses on the insurance, but there are a lot of public health things in there as well, that, I thought had a good likelihood of benefiting my patients kind of overall by changing the communities rather than kind of me trying to kind of ineffectively change behavior one by one.
My husband was talking to my brother-in-law one day. My brother-in-law is a physician, and he was telling my husband, you don't have to go for an annual checkup. I think my husband had just gone for an annual checkup. And my brother-in-law said, you don't need to go for an annual checkup. And my husband says, well, no, it's a good idea. He says, no, my husband's an actuary. He says, I dare you to show me statistically why you need an annual checkup. My husband said, well, I don't have any statistics for you. He said, but I think it's a good idea. Every year, my doctor tells me I should exercise more. And I was listening to the conversation, and I said, and every year you ignore him. Yeah, I'm going to guess it's the kind of frustration you were talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's move on to your blog. Can you tell us about your blog and why you decided to write it?
So the story behind the blog, which is actually will turn 10 years old in 2 weeks, I realized.
Oh, it's really been a while.
Yeah, it's been going on for a while. And I started it originally because I took this science writing class. I've dabbled in science writing in college and a little bit in med school and residency. I wrote, occasional kind of medical articles. I just felt like taking this writing class is a really nice place in DC called the Writing Center, where you can go and sit with people who are, I don't think there was a single other physician in that class, although there were other help. There was a nurse and I think a couple of medical technicians. And I took the class, and I disclosed it, and people asked, you know, why are you taking this class? And I said, well, one of my mentors was a family physician who for a long time wrote this column for the Washington Post in the health section. The problem is these days, most newspapers don't have room for that just because of financial reasons. And they said, well, you know, that's so like 1980. I mean, you should write a blog, and you should, you know, and that's how you can get your message out, write about whatever you want. You won't have, you know, you'll be your own editor. So during class, I started writing it, and I said, okay. And I went on, figured out how to write a blog, wrote a few posts. You know, the only people who was reading it at that time were the you know, five or six people in the class, plus a couple family members. But despite that, even though I had virtually no audience, I found that I really did enjoy it. And then I started writing, you know, twice a week, once or twice a week, on whatever I felt like writing about, although there seemed to be certain themes about, you know, health reform and preventive medicine, and just certain interests of mine. And then to my surprise, the numbers started ticking up, and I realized I was building this audience through social media, through, you know, word of mouth. I think that kind of at its peak, it was probably, I have probably had a few hundred regular people who were either receiving the blog by email or were logging on to read it. And I think that's about the maximum that's been. It's been steady probably for the last several years. But I said that's enough for me to feel like I've got to keep this thing going, because I'm going to let people know if I stop. Because there were a lot of times where I thought, yeah, maybe I'm wasting my time. I'm a doctor. I'm busy. I have four kids now. I only had two kids then. Mm-hmm. But it just got busier and busier. But every time I thought about, oh, I'll just stop, you know, and abandon it. Like there would always be somebody saying, oh, I just read your latest post. It was so good. I had this reflection about it and I wanted to talk about it. We even recruited a few patients through the blog, although that was never really my intention. I actually try to keep those worlds pretty separate. But I have had a few people who've found me and then looked me up and, you know, on Google and showed up in my office and said, I found you because I read this blog post and I know your philosophy of medicine is what I want.
Nice. That's pretty good. That is great. So you're keeping it up after 10 years.
Yep. And I have no plans to stop anytime soon.
All right. Now you've gone through medical training and taught physicians in training, and you're currently a professor at three different universities. What do you think pre-meds and med students don't think about enough as they begin their training? What do they sometimes just not get, or again, don't think about enough?
Well, it's funny when I interview prospective students to come here to Georgetown, I joke that I don't know that I would have accepted myself when I went to med school. I feel like to students of today, I had, even though I tried in college to explore new experiences and sort of stay away from the traditional track, I mean, I still had relatively little life experience. I think that a lot of students these days are taking a year or two off between college and med school, you know, the so-called gap year or, you know, gap years, depending on what you end up doing, you know, getting master's degree or working or traveling somewhere.
I just interviewed a medical school admissions director who said that she heard that it should be called a growth year as opposed to a gap
year. Yeah,
I think that's a great title for it.
It's a positive in my mind, kind of regardless of what you do. I mean, I guess there could be some negative things you could do. You could just sit around and do nothing. But, you know, they're not doing that. And I think as I've seen more and more students do that, I also see that the students who tend to succeed in med school, they have those kinds of experiences. I think, like, everybody who comes into med school was usually at the top of their class and they kind of, you know, cruised along and they may have struggled at some point. But when you hit med school, everything gets exponentially tougher and it really, but it's all about kind of just putting your head down and getting through and keeping your emotional and your keeping yourself sane. And I find that people with more diverse life experiences end up being able to adapt better, that they're just more willing to roll with the punches and say, it's okay. Like, I don't have, everything doesn't have to be perfect. The whole keep their eyes on the goal, which is, you know, after all, becoming a doctor and not necessarily getting, you know, top grades in your preclinical classes that are, you know, not really going to matter down the line.
Right. Every so often I'll talk to applicants or I'll talk to a parent. And for whatever reason, I'll say, look, you know, you're going to have a really hard time, let's say, filling in all the classes that you need before the MCAT. Why don't you spread it out a little bit, take the MCAT, let's say, after your junior year, in college and then take a gap year or more. And they said, no, I don't want to lose a year. And I said, well, you can use it or lose it. You don't lose it. I'm not suggesting that you lose it, but use it for personal growth, additional clinical experience, travel, you know, whatever it might be. And I think I hope that the term gap year is ultimately replaced with the term growth year, because that's how it should be viewed, not just as some kind of filler, you know. I think that's a bit of a mistake. What would you have done differently in your medical training as you look back on it?
I think if I had known early on that I was interested in public health, I actually, at the medical school here, I teach a course that's called Patients, Populations, and Policy, it's an introductory public health course, although geared toward medical students and people who are going to become physicians. We didn't have that kind of course when I was in med school, so I wouldn't, you know, my first year med school was anatomy, biochemistry,
sciences.
I mean, there was no, everything was sort of the hard science. There was no soft, and so I didn't really realize until I was a few years into my career and already a full-fledged physician that it would have been nice if I had taken some classes in that. I think the closest thing was we had a class of statistics in med school, which I actually enjoyed quite a bit, and everybody else, I think, disliked it. That was kind of strange. Maybe that's why I became a family doctor and they all became orthopedic surgeons or something. But it turns out statistics, you know, is one of those things, the tools of public health. So,
sure.
So I think if I had known that, I probably would have tried. I could have gotten a public health degree either in med school or maybe immediately after med school or in residency, where I really could have worked it into my career rather than kind of come out and sort of learn a lot of things on the fly.
What was one of the best things that you did as a physician in training, looking back?
Well, I think, you know, getting out of, so I went to med school in New York City and I went to a very fine med school. It's only, I think, gotten better since I left in terms of the opportunities and the quality of the students. But all of my rotations were nationally urban rotations. And so I deliberately pursued a couple of rotations that were completely not urban. One suburban kind of at a hospital in Pennsylvania where I did a family medicine rotation. And I did one rotation in the Indian Health Service, which is quite rural, out in the Zuni Reservation in New Mexico, which was terrific. It was just very different. It's not to say really that there's any that, you know, rural or urban medicine both have their own, you know, advantages and disadvantages. But getting that experience, I think, gave me more of really, I think, pointed me more toward family medicine. I think if you're in an urban environment, you tend to be surrounded by subspecialists and kind of generalist practice is not as valued or emphasized in your education. So I think, you know, by purposely pursuing that, I kept my mind open to, you know, what ultimately would be a primary care career.
All right. And you also probably experienced a side of medicine that you wouldn't have experienced and probably haven't experienced since you've stayed pretty much on the East Coast, correct?
Yeah. My wife, early in her career, my wife's also a family physician, did a rotation mm-hmm. in Alaska, which she still talks about. It was like 20 years ago. We keep saying, well, the kids are big enough. We're just going to go to Alaska for a few months and be, you know, kind of wilderness doctors and
was working on a tour of Alaska several years ago. And he also just said it was fantastic. And hopefully one day my husband and I will get there too. Now, we talked about your blog a minute ago and how you actually have this very nice, healthy following on it. As part of your blog, you wrote a thoughtful critique of the U.S. News Med School Rankings, which we're going to link to that particular post from the show notes at accept.com/321. But for right now, can you summarize your critique?
So the blog post was kind of a critique of, so the U.S. News rankings of, they rank kind of college, you know, graduate education and medical school specifically. And mm-hmm. I had read this article in the journal Academic Medicine by an educator who pointed out that the rankings are kind of arbitrary. They're based on things which don't necessarily have a connection to producing good physicians, like really high MCAT scores or really high grades in certain science subjects, which you need for preparation for medicine, but you don't necessarily have to have the top scores. And by selecting the students with the, with the top scores and saying that, oh, the schools that, that have the most, that select the students with the highest scores in these things are the best schools, then you end up both misportraying, you know, medicine as only for, you know, only for those type of people who do really well on tests, and in some specialties may actually not select people at all who would have been, you know, great pediatricians or, you know, or general internists or family physicians. It sort of got, it started when I read that article, but then it sort of got me thinking about, well, what are, and reading a little bit about, like, what are the qualities that are needed? Like if you look back retrospectively and say, these are, you know, this is a place that produces really great family doctors. Well, where do these people come from? What criteria do they use to select them? And I think some schools are doing that to some degree. I mean, we're, you know, it's obviously harder to take into account qualities like character, because how do you measure that? You can't do a standardized test of that necessarily. But there are ways to measure things like grit and to look at to their tests for implicit bias and things that will hurt you as a physician if you have them, or if you, you know, or positive qualities that you lack. So that's, you know, that's mainly the point of the post was, you know, I think U.S. News, you know, at a minimum, if they keep ranking, they should incorporate other things in their rankings to make them more accurate. But perhaps, you know, that schools shouldn't pay so much attention to those rankings in deciding how, you know, what students to admit, that they really should be focusing on creating the types of doctors they want to come out of their school rather than, you know, what will nudge them a notch up the ranking scale.
Right. I think the whole rankings game, my impression, and we work with MBA law students also, is that rankings actually play a far bigger role in those professions than in medicine.
And, yeah, you know,
it's a lot nuttier. In medicine, most of our clients, yes, there are those who are looking at the rankings. We want to go to a top medical school. But most of them are just hoping they get into a U.S. allopathic medical school or right. A U.S. MD or DO school. So it's a little bit less crazy in medicine than in the other two specialties that I just mentioned, or not to mention undergrad, which is, you know, a whole different beast.
I was listening to Malcolm Gladwell's podcast, and he did an episode on the LSAT where he took the LSAT and one of his assistants took it. And he said, basically, if you don't score high on the LSAT, you don't get into Harvard, or there's some handful of good law schools, you don't become a Supreme Court clerk and your career's over or something. So
it's not quite that bad. But yeah, I once was giving a webinar again in MBA admissions. And the people who asked me to present said, look, the focus on rankings is just crazy. Can you please talk about rankings? Because I also feel that they're overemphasized. And so I went and I looked for CEOs that did not go to top 10 or 15 or whatever MBA programs. And the head of Walgreens, I think, you know, went to a completely non-ranked school. You know, Bill Gates dropped out of Harvard. Michael Dell never finished college. You know, so it's not so much that those programs don't do anything. I do think that they do something, but that they're not the only way to achieve, number one. And number two, I think it's incumbent upon every applicant to decide what's important to them. So if being with people who have high MCAT scores is important to you, then U.S. News is measuring something that's of value. But if you were designing a ranking, or if you were simply looking at medical schools, what should applicants be looking at, in your opinion?
Well, I think they. I think one probably the most of the statistics that are collected, like the percentage of people who go into primary care and various subspecialties, I think is really important, especially if you have sort of already in mind, well, I'm thinking that I want to become, you know, a radiologist or something, then you're naturally going to want to go to a school where there's a strong radiology department. There's lots of support for radiologists. I often wonder what would have happened if I was accepted to several medical schools, but if I had not gotten into NYU, I probably would have gotten to my state school, which was the University of Maryland, which has a much stronger, you know, in retrospect, primary care program. They produce many more physicians who go on to become pediatricians, and I wanted to be a pediatrician when I went to medical school, even though I ended up being a family physician. And one of my complaints about my medical school was that they didn't have really strong support for people who wanted to go into primary care. They thought, well, I could have gone to the University of Maryland and paid, you know, half the tuition and still maybe become a family physician. Although you never really know how that would have turned out. Maybe it would have turned me off to it or something. I felt like in some ways I was being a little rebellious and going against the grain of what, you know, many of my classmates wanted to do. So I think that will give you some sense. Like, you really don't want to go to a school where, although, you know, there are people who become family physicians who graduate from Harvard. It's fairly rare, and I'm sure they feel a little bit isolated too. And more power to them for making that decision. We in family medicine call, there are, I think, like maybe 8 or 9 schools left who don't have departments of family medicine. NYU is one of them. Harvard's another one. We call them orphan schools, which is derogatory, but like, you know, basically schools where if you want to go into family medicine, you're kind of an orphan because there's nobody you could turn to at the school. You usually have to have mentors outside of the school. And I was lucky enough to find a few.
Right. So I guess one of the, it certainly seems like it makes sense to me, if one has direction in medicine, then one should look at where graduates of a particular medical school are going. Obviously, you also have to look at in-state versus out-of-state. I think it's a highly relevant criterion. But I think that looking at where graduates go and how that matches up with your interests is one really good criterion. And it's not at all reflected in U.S. news. It can't be.
I think the other thing to get a sense of, and I think you can get a sense of this, it may not be quite as easy as just looking at a page in a rankings book, but of the places that they tend to train at, NYU wasn't terribly supportive of primary care, but one thing I really loved about it is that their public hospital, Bellevue, is sort of the legend. Yeah. Like, this is where, you know, people learn, and, you know, anybody can come here, and it was open to, we'd have people who'd step off the plane from Africa and they'd flown to New York City just so they could go to Bellevue to get treated for something. And that really that created kind of an ethos around the institution that I really enjoyed, where, you know, you felt like, you know, like, we're open to everybody. We do not discriminate. We're not, we don't really care if you have insurance, you don't have insurance. And, you know, some schools are, their teaching hospitals are more privatized. They're, you know, maybe catered to a more high income clientele. That may be what you want, or if you're more interested in serving the underserved or serving a global population or a rural population, then you really have to look at those institutions and, you know, where are you going to be getting your training, because you're going to spend hours and hours and hours, you know, and you want to make sure that that's the kind of place you want to spend your time.
For sure. What advice do you have for pre-meds and med students?
I mean, for pre-meds, I would just encourage to kind of enjoy your undergraduate experience and don't do any more than the minimum requirements for medicine, unless you want to. You know, if you really love physics and you want to go and go beyond the basics physics course, that's fine. I personally wonder why physics is required for medical school at all. It seems kind of antiquated, but, you know, and the same thing, it's like if you've taken the math requirements, you don't have to take any more math. One of my regrets is I took a math course I probably didn't need to take when I was in college, so I already fulfilled the requirements, but I said, oh, I'm good at math, and I'll just take another. That really wasn't, you know, it maybe cost me a history course or something else I would have enjoyed more. So, because there's really, there may have been in the past some skepticism in medical schools about people who didn't major in biology or chemistry, but these days it's almost 50-50, I think, what I see, at least who we interview. Those things. So, you know, kind of pursue your passion. Med school, I mean, some similar advice. I mean, the med school curriculum obviously is a lot less flexible. I mean, most of the classes are required in med school. You know, though, some of my best experiences were, you know, finding time for extracurriculars, which was, there was a lot less time in med school than in college, but I contributed to a literary magazine. We had this club that went to a local high school and did like science experiments for like third graders, and it was fun to get out and do that and remember kind of your humanity, especially when you're kind of in the first 2 years, which is, you know, mostly like you're studying and studying and studying to kind of keep that alive. You know, and these days there's a lot more opportunities to do some clinical work preclinically. So we have you know, our medical school, a free clinic. I'm sure a lot of students' schools do, where students basically run the thing. I mean, there are faculty around just to make sure you don't do anything crazy. It's, you know, basically our free clinic would not exist if were it not for the time that students spend to organize it and take care of people who otherwise would just not be served at all at the homeless shelters that are kind of hospitals in D.C.
So I guess in both cases, it would be make time for other interests. Don't be so tunnel vision focused on medicine, pre-med or medical student career, right? Would that be a fairly good summary of what you're saying?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. What do you wish I had asked you?
What do I wish you'd asked me? Well, I think, you know, one thing that I get asked about a lot is, you know, why did you decide to go into academic medicine versus not? Okay. I think part of it was because I enjoy, you know, reading, you know, both for pleasure, but also like scientific research articles. I like learning about new things. And I felt like, well, that kind of, if you're in full-time practice, like it's really hard to keep up on your journals. Like, and if you're an academic, kind of, that's sort of part of your job. I'm supposed to be up to date so I can teach students about the latest things. But I, you know, I also enjoy teaching. It's kind of a sense that you may have to develop, but even in med school, you can, you know, you probably have to give talks and you can kind of learn whether you enjoy kind of the going up to lecture or teaching a small group. We have like third years who mentor first years in our school and teach them like evidence-based medicine and things like that. That's kind of how you can tell whether you want to go in one or another. I mean, academic medicine has some disadvantages. You know, the pay's a little lower. We sometimes get, the physicians are not in academia say, oh, you're off in your ivory tower and you're not really in touch with real life medicine. And my practice isn't as big because I only see patients about half the time rather than like every, rather than 4 or 5 days a week. But I think the variety is what I really like most about it, that, you know, I'll see patients one day and the next day I'm giving a talk somewhere, I'm writing a paper, I'm doing a podcast. It keeps things interesting. It kind of, even when the medicine gets a little bit old, the activities continue to be new and enjoyable.
Okay, great. Well, I want to thank you very much. It was an interesting answer. Basically, it's the variety. Dr. Lin, I think we're running out of time, and I know you're really busy. So I want to thank you very much for joining me for this show, and I want to thank you for sharing your experience and perspective. Where can listeners find out more about you, and where can they find your blog?
Well, my blog is Common Sense Family Doctor. You can just Google that, and it should be the first thing that comes up, or Common Sense MD. And that's pretty much where I have all my stuff. I've got, so if you're interested in contacting me, you can always reach out to me through that. And I'm also on Twitter, Kenny Lin AFP, if anyone wants to communicate with me through social media.
So, okay, great.
As I said, I don't recruit patients on social media in D.C. And occasionally, you know, if you've got a listener who's looking for a family doctor, I am still taking new patients.
All right. Wonderful. We're going to link from the show notes at accept.com/321 to Dr. Lin's blog, the blog post about med school rankings, as well as other related resources and his Twitter feed too. Listener, thank you too for tuning into this, our 321st episode. If you find this show worthwhile, please make sure you don't miss any others. Subscribe through your favorite podcatcher. We have subscribe links in the show notes at accept.com/321. And a quick reminder to download Accepted's free guide, The Ultimate Guide to Medical School Interview Success, which you can do at accepted.com/321download. This is Admissions Trade Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week. Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.